Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. If you want to change the world or the country or even your own neighborhood, you need to get other people on board and convince them to accept a new normal. For that to happen, your changes need to work for a wide variety of people, including those who can benefit from your idea even if they don't share your passion. Take car sharing, for example. Although its strongest proponents are people who don't want to own more than they need or who think it's good for the environment to have fewer vehicles on the road, car sharing can also be a good option for folks looking to avoid the hassle and expense of maintaining a vehicle, but who need to drive occasionally. Gabriel Metcalf is here to talk about how alternative institutions can change the way people live and about what it takes to build and support them. He is executive director of the San Francisco Bay Area Planning and Urban Research Association, known as SPUR, and a founder of Car Sharing in North America. He's also the author of a new book called Democratic by Design: How Car Sharing, Co-ops, and Community Land Trusts Are Reinventing America. Gabriel, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
What aspects of America do you think need reinventing?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that there's a lot going right in our country, but there's a lot that's not going right. In my book, I kind of focus on three realms where I think we especially need work, and they're big realms, but I focus on the economy, I focus on the democratic process. And then the third grouping is what I call place-based institutions, how we take care of cities and take care of the land.
What are alternative institutions and how do they, and we'll get into the three examples that you just gave, but what are alternative institutions? How do they differ from what exists now in all of these areas?
Yeah, so I try to develop basically a theory of social change that I think is available to progressives in America, and I actually think it's been a widespread tradition in our history, but it's been maybe underappreciated and understudied. And the basic idea is this: is that you create in the here and now a living example of the way things should work. And you use that as an experiment, and you make revisions as needed. And if it starts to work, then you try to scale it up and outcompete the mainstream institutions. And I open with a case study of car sharing in San Francisco, but I actually think you could even think about public radio as an alternative institution. Other examples people will have a lot of familiarity with are credit unions and co-ops and community land trusts. So there are actually a lot of examples.
One thing that's really interesting in these kinds of institutions that you talk about, these alternative institutions, is that you call them a strategy of minimum consensus. Explain what that means.
Yeah, I really was struck in my own kind of education as an activist about this tendency on the left to kind of demand that people buy into this kind of whole analysis of the system or the underlying problems, and that's kind of how you show that you're smart and that you're not superficial, that you really want to make things better, is you subscribe to a very well-developed analysis of what's wrong. And the problem with that is that I think it's very limiting. It sort of suggests that your main job as a progressive is to convince other people to share your analysis. And from that, everything else follows. My own experiences as an activist have led me to approach that differently and to think that a strategy of minimal consensus is actually sometimes just fine. And what I mean by that is that if you are working on a project, like you want to start a renewable energy co-op, putting solar panels on people's roofs, and saving them money and helping reduce global warming, it really doesn't matter if people share a progressive critique of the military petroleum industrial complex or if they're worried about oil wars. They can be motivated by just wanting to save money, and that's perfectly fine. The point is you want to get more people enrolled in your program. And so I think we should be more focused on what our institutions are actually doing in the world. And if they're good, then we want them to grow, and we don't need to care what people's motivations are.
So I guess another example would be, you know, shopping at the grocery store. A lot more people today bring their own bags than used to. It doesn't matter if they're doing it because they don't want plastic generated or because they want the nickel that you get back for every plastic bag you don't take.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So the idea then is that you can arrive at substantive change from the ground up rather than waiting for everybody to agree on sweeping change that happens across the board. It's still not easy to get things started from the ground up, as you learned when you devoted 6 years of your life to establishing a car sharing cooperative.
Yeah, I think we were probably quite naive about what it would take. We showed up in San Francisco after college, and we knew about car sharing from the German and the Swiss car sharing clubs, and those were, I guess, organized as co-ops. And we're like, this makes so much sense. Why don't we have this in America? And so we started working on it, and it, you know, a lot of people thought it was just insane. Like, Americans love their cars too much; they'll never give them up. What are you talking about? And it took a lot longer than we thought. And of course, we had to convince people to give us money so we could buy cars, and we had to invent a technology. Some of that would be easier today because the world has changed and the technology is a lot more accessible. But yeah, it's a lot of work to build an alternative institution.
What goals did you have for the organization?
You know, our real goal was to initially demonstrate that there is another way possible, that not everybody needs to own a car. And we had this slogan that car sharing was like methadone for car addicts. And the idea being that you might still need to drive a bunch, but you don't have to own the car. You can just have a car when you need it. And our theory was that would have at least one really big benefit for cities, which is it would reduce the number of vehicles that have to be stored, meaning parked, inside cities. And that would in turn allow us to reclaim the space for other purposes, for housing or for parks or for bike lanes, that the scarcest commodity of all is urban real estate, and we were devoting so much of it to warehousing vehicles. So if we could get, instead of, you know, 10 cars for 10 households, we could get one car for 10 households, that would free up the space. There was also a theory that once people got used to paying every time they drove, they would experience a little bit of a financial incentive to drive less and maybe conserve. So this was more theoretical at the time, but maybe it would lead to people driving less over time. And so we didn't know if it would just stay small or if it would turn out to get big. In our more grandiose moments, we hoped we would really drive down the car ownership rate in America, which hasn't happened yet, but I think we're on the way, actually.
So it didn't really matter to you. You could definitely have people who shared all those ideals. You were also happy to sign up people who ordinarily might, you know, don't own a car, but might rent a car from Hertz or Avis when they need one.
Sure. And we were happy to sign up businesses so their employees could use a car during work. And we were happy to sign up developers who could offer it in their buildings. So yeah, once we thought this idea was going to really be helpful, and so once we decided that, we were happy to sign up anybody who related to it for whatever reason.
What did you have to consider as you decided whether this would be a for-profit or not-for-profit venture?
Yeah, that was one of the great debates. We considered it being a for-profit, a nonprofit. We also thought about it being a co-op. And we even a little bit thought about it being a public institution, being run out of the transit authority, which is a model that some European cities have. We ultimately decided it should be a public benefit, nonprofit corporation. And our main reason is that we thought there were a lot of ways that car sharing could, we would face choices to make decisions that would maybe benefit members or maybe benefit the community as a whole. So, for example, were we going to do marketing campaigns that would try to get people to drive more because we wanted the revenue? And it seemed like that was a bad idea. And the way to try to establish kind of in the DNA of the organization that it would be focused on the public good rather than sort of member benefit, if those ever were to conflict, would be to set it up as a nonprofit. So that was our decision.
Some of the goals that you had facilitated the kinds of partnerships that you made within the community. So, for example, you know, developments, apartment complexes that would have, you know, a pod of these cars available, or, you know, community organizations that wanted fewer cars parked along a particular street.
Yeah, that's right. We had a lot of, I would say, community institutions were key to starting this. So neighborhood groups, environmental groups, developers. We did get a lot of support from city government, kind of letting us have parking spaces in the early days. And the bus system let us put ads on the transit vehicles. And then a lot of businesses joined. And yeah. So I would say that strategy of having anchor institutions in the community support an alternative institution is actually a recurring theme, and I think it's one of the ways that we can actually make them successful.
Well, it also certainly adds credibility, right? That you're this new player in a space, but you have the trust, it would appear, of other organizations that people already interact with.
Right. And then the first ones to sign up were taking a risk to lend their credibility to this unproven concept. And then over time, it got easier for more organizations to sign up.
What told you in the beginning that your service could give people this glimpse of a better future that, you know, much broader utilization of shared assets would present within the community?
Well, you know, I'd like to say we were totally sure it would work, but of course we were not. And as we were reading these stories from, you know, journalists and environmental writers about Berlin in particular, and there were this kind of flowering of housing co-ops and workers co-ops and eco buildings and this whole kind of story of what was happening in Berlin in the, you know, immediate aftermath of the wall coming down. And it sounded like this kind of experimental, not a utopia, but a real center of creativity around urban life. But always in those stories, they talk about the car sharing clubs as one of the examples. And we just thought, this has got to be something that could work in the United States.
Gabriel Metcalf is my guest. He's a founder of car sharing in North America and author of a new book called Democratic by Design: How Car Sharing, Co-ops, and Community Land Trusts Are Reinventing America. Join our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest for the hour is Gabriel Metcalf. He's executive director of the SF Bay Area Planning and Urban Research Association and author of a new book called Democratic by Design, How Car Sharing, Co-ops, and Community Land Trusts Are Reinventing America. Gabriel, one thing that you say is that everybody with an alternative institution needs to consider whether the general public already understands the nature of the problem that you're trying to solve or whether your real goal is just raising awareness about the problem itself. Why is that an important distinction?
Yeah, good question. You know, even though I wrote a book about alternative institutions, it's not like it's the only strategy that progressives need to use. We also need to use, you know, political organizing and electoral politics and cultural change or what sometimes gets called consciousness raising is also a big part of what we need to do. And I actually profile some social movements that I think have done an especially good job sort of putting all of those pieces together, using a lot of strategies, including alternative institutions. But when it comes to building an alternative institution, if you see something that nobody else sees, you might not be able to get people to kind of sign up. And so I think figuring out what is going to be transformative in your particular time and place, your particular moment in history is a lot of the art.
All right, let's move on to democracy. How can we apply thinking about beneficial alternative institutions or approaches to the challenges that we see in American democracy today?
Yeah, so my telling of that story actually starts with the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. And I think that it actually is sort of the ultimate example of the theory of change that I'm writing about. What actually happened is that the New England town meetings and the town meetings, you know, were spread outside of New England, although they were strongest there, formed in nascent form the new democratic structure of the government while the colonial system was still in place. And actually we had for many decades two different layers, two competing systems, two competing theories of government existing in the same space. So we had the royal charters and the crown-appointed governors on the one hand, and then we had these bottom-up town meetings who started sending delegates to the legislatures. And the actual fighting part of the revolution came after that. And that it was, in a sense, defending this alternative system of government that already existed. And so that's why when the revolutionaries won, there was not chaos. There was no descent into the kind of barbarism that we've sometimes seen in the world. It's because the alternative had already been prepared. It had already been developed and practiced for a long time. So I actually think we can understand our own founding as a democracy through the lens of alternative institutions. The problem is that while maybe our system of government has worked very well for a long time, it's showing, I think, some of the strains of age. And there are many ways it is not working that well. And I actually think it is in need of some revitalization and almost a spirit of experimentation to try to develop some new forms of democratic practice. And so I try to explore what some of those might look like.
Sometimes we almost romanticize, you know, the town hall meeting as a kind of gold standard of participatory democracy. But as you point out in the book, there are some challenges to that, not least of which is that in a setting where everybody gets a voice, the loudest voices tend to dominate whether or not they belong to the most thoughtful and qualified speakers.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, whether we're thinking about the American town meeting tradition or the Athenian polis, I think it's very easy to romanticize that idea of the General Assembly, where everyone gathers and debates the issues of the day and raises each other's consciousness and comes to a good decision together, and that's how it's supposed to work. But I think the thing we have to remember is that American life today is filled with our own versions of that at the local level, the neighborhood meetings, the planning commission meetings, the PTA meetings. There's this whole experience we have of actually existing participatory democracy, and the real life experience of those is not so good. They suffer from a terrible self-selection problem, meaning that most people don't show up, so they are not representative of most people in a community. And then the conversations usually do not tend to be very good. As you say, the people with the loudest voices dominate. And so I don't think we can kind of hold out this romantic notion of participatory democracy without subjecting that to the scrutiny of what that actually looks like in our own experience.
So how can we do it as well as possible?
Yeah, so that's the big question. I think that, I mean, for one thing, we probably need to honor the importance of the process and investing more energy in having a better process wherever we're gathering people together to make decisions. I think sometimes progressives are just as guilty as conservatives of sort of showing up to push their agenda, but no one is taking ownership to think about designing a process that will actually be democratic, which might not always lead to progressive outcomes, but would be good for the whole community, good for the democracy. I think one model that I write about a lot that is coming out of especially the Pacific Northwest is a concept of citizen juries, and this was actually one of the early experiments was with the Texas utility system. But the idea here is that you randomly select who's going to participate, like in a poll. So you are overcoming the problem of self-selection. And then you gather a group of people together to deliberate on a question. And in the case of the Texas example in the mid-90s, it was a rate-setting process. And they were trying to understand if Texans would be willing to pay higher rates in order to subsidize poor people and in order to support renewable energy. It's the kind of question where you would think, oh, Americans are too selfish to do that kind of thing. But they designed a process where they randomly selected a group of people, and then they really provided them with information, with speakers on both sides of issues, and they took a lot of time to actually educate the people who were doing it, as if you were on a jury hearing a trial. You invest the time hearing evidence, and at the end, then they had their deliberation and they made their decisions, and they actually were willing to support higher utility rates. And so it's a model we see coming out of Vancouver, British Columbia a lot, where they're selecting citizen juries who develop ballot measures sometimes that then the whole province votes on.
What does it take for a business to legitimately call itself socially responsible?
Yeah, really good question. You know, my starting premise is that most people are good people and most businesses would like to do the right thing. And so I'm giving the benefit of the doubt to what is undoubtedly a large and varied group of people. But my premise is that if people could, they would like their businesses to be good for the world. And yes, they want to make money, but they'd rather not destroy the earth or destroy communities if they didn't have to. And so the question I want to ask, though, is then if that's true, why is not every business socially responsible? And I think it really gets to the heart of the dynamics of competition in a global economy, that if your business does the right thing and you're competing with a business that can save money by cutting wages or not taking care of its pollution, normally the business that takes the low road, if you will, is going to win because it'll have lower costs. So the problem I think we face is, how do we enlarge the space for companies to take the high road, to do the right thing? And I think this is a question where obviously part of that lies in sort of traditional strategies of regulation, right? If the EPA is enforcing environmental standards, then they've set a floor, and that's part of the answer. But of course, companies can then leave the United States and go somewhere they don't face those kind of regulations. So I think what an alternative institution strategy brings to this question is the idea of aggregating capital for high road businesses and aggregating customer demand for high road businesses. So those are two of the concepts I really explore. With capital, the idea is that there are many mission-driven organizations that control capital. They are university endowments, foundation endowments, labor union pension funds. When you add those up, it's a huge portion of the economy. In theory, if those institutions were using their investment capital in the right way, they could decide to invest only in socially responsible businesses. That kind of a decision would really change the game and really enlarge the space for socially responsible businesses to work in.
Should consumers expect to have to pay more to patronize socially responsible businesses?
Probably yes, in some cases. One of the social movements I profile is the sustainable food movement. And I think it is true that if you're paying your workers decent wages, and not just, you know, the guy bagging your groceries, but the farm workers and the factory workers and the entire system of the food industry, if everybody there is making a decent living wage and you're not mining the topsoil, you're taking care of it and you're reinvesting in the land, it is more labor intensive, and I think the food is going to cost more. And I think we have to kind of say we are a wealthy society. That is a worthwhile investment.
Can you explain what the Cleveland model is?
Yeah, the Cleveland model is a really exciting example, a really exciting case study here. Basically, Cleveland is one of those cities in the Midwest that has been struggling with deindustrialization for decades. It has very high rates of poverty in some of the inner city neighborhoods and very high rates of unemployment. And the Cleveland Foundation, the community foundation there, hit on a new strategy adapted from the Mondragon cooperatives in Spain. And basically, it was a strategy of setting up a network of worker co-ops. And the key innovation is that they got some of the anchor institutions, using that term again, anchor institutions, in this case, hospitals and universities who were in downtown Cleveland, to agree to support the worker co-ops. So the first one they started was a laundry service, and the hospital said, okay, we'll use you for our outsourced laundry service. So they provided a kind of baseline set of business that allowed this laundry co-op to borrow money and invest in equipment. And so you now have these people who had been unemployed, who are learning skills, who actually own a share of the business. They both have a paycheck and they're building wealth through the equity. And now other institutions in Cleveland can patronize them, and there's a way they can kind of grow viably. For the hospital, even if it costs a little bit more, it is you know, pennies under the couch cushions. It's something they can easily afford. And so it's using the power of the anchor institutions to get an alternative institution started.
What role is there for banks to enter into the realm of socially responsible ventures?
Well, boy, wouldn't that be amazing if the banking industry became a big part of the solution? I look at the financial industry in my chapter on the economy, and I mean, I think one thing to realize is that the credit union movement is enormous in the United States, and I think it's almost a third of Americans are members of credit unions, and credit unions are co-ops. They don't necessarily always act like it, and in some cases, I think they have become somewhat indistinguishable from banks, but they are controlled by boards of directors, elected by their members, and they are one of the great success stories of an earlier wave of alternative institution building, you know, more in the 1930s. I think there are community banks. There's more going on in banking than just the big Wall Street banks. And so I think there's enormous potential to have some of those mission-driven financial institutions be part of the solution.
We're speaking this hour with Gabriel Metcalf, Executive Director of the SF Bay Area Planning and Urban Research Association and a founder of Car Sharing in North America. His new book is called Democratic by Design, How Car Sharing, Co-ops, and Community Land Trusts Are Reinventing America. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet. My handle is @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for spring 2016 to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with urban planner Gabriel Metcalf, author of Democratic by Design, How Car Sharing, Co-ops, and Community Land Trusts Are Reinventing America. Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Bill on the line in Dallas. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Really enjoying the show and your speaker today, Chris.
Thank you.
How can we save democracy from our own congressional representatives who are willing to keep giving new and expanded entitlements to citizens in return for our votes, all the time kicking the can of increased costs down the road to our children and grandchildren?
Thanks for your call.
Am I supposed to answer that?
I don't know. Do you have thoughts on this?
Just a small question like that. I would like to take that as a rhetorical question, but because I don't know the answer.
Mm-hmm. Is it the kind of thing that you worry about, though, that you feel like, I mean, you know, you want to scale any ideas that you have, certainly, but you've got to get them up and running first. Are they scalable all the way to the level of Capitol Hill?
You know, in many ways, I would say the strategy of alternative institutions is appealing because unlike national reforms, it's not blocked. There's so much sclerosis of our national political system because the two parties are deadlocked, and there's such growing disagreement and polarization at the national level. But at the local level, people often are much more practical. So maybe that's why I focused on the local level so much in my own work, is precisely because I don't know what you do about some of those big national problems.
One thing that any organization has to grapple with, even if they don't necessarily fall victim to it, is the concern about selling out as a socially responsible venture that does get bigger or, you know, take on a greater scope of operations.
Yeah. There's this concept of being co-opted or selling out, which is really just a fancy word for, I suppose, compromising more than somebody thinks you should have compromised. But it is something to worry about, I guess, anytime you're starting a project. They're so hard to keep going. It can be very tempting to just do whatever it takes to keep them going, and there may be times when you need to let them not keep going if that's what it takes. There may be other times where the compromises you make are exactly what you should do. So it's a very there's a real art in that, and I don't think there are easy answers. I end up profiling the early affordable housing movement in America, which had a vision of providing public housing for the broad working class, which is a model that some of the Western European democracies were pursuing. The way it worked out during the New Deal, they made this compromise to get public housing funded in America, but only for the poorest of the poor. And they also agreed to a compromise where cities would have to tear down a unit of so-called slum housing for every unit of public housing they built. So those two compromises, limiting the kind of income level of the housing and having to tear down the substandard housing, meant that we did create a public housing program in America, but it ended up not at all looking like the European models. It ended up becoming a stigmatized sort of recreation of the ghetto, where only the poorest of the poor could go. It is one of the kind of tragic examples in American history where very idealistic people agreed to something that ended up in some ways having the opposite effects of their intentions.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Bruce in Irving. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I was wondering if your guest had heard about the Venus Project by directed by futurist Jacques Fresco, and if he had his thoughts about the idea of redesigning the city systems to be more efficient. And also I had heard recently from one of the presidential candidates about reinventing the post office to be more like a bank to handle certain things like check cashing and maybe licensing and fees of some nature. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Okay, I don't know about the Venus Project, but I do know this idea of adding more services at post offices, which I think is actually a great idea. One of the big issues for the working poor in America is that they are underbanked. They often have to go to check cashing places, which take a huge portion of their income. Getting the post office, which, you know, we Americans like to complain about government, but basically the post office works pretty well. Getting it to provide some basic banking services seems like a very sensible idea that would help a lot of people.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Carlo is on the line now in Lake Dallas. Hi, Carlo.
Hey, I guess my question was, why exactly is it, you know, taxpayers and these anchoring institutions' job, or should there be an expectation for them to help further subsidize these co-ops and other programs when it seems there's plenty of opportunity if people want to go out there and make more money or grow their wealth for them to do it without expecting these subsidies?
What do you think, Gabriel?
Yeah, good question. You know, it depends on where you live, and it also depends on what kind of opportunities you had growing up. What what sets of opportunities are available to people. Look, I live in San Francisco. We've got a lot of jobs, and people with good skills can easily get a job here. That's not true in Cleveland, and it's not true in lots of America, where people are really trapped in neighborhoods with very little job opportunity. Moreover, people who grew up, you know, maybe without intact families, who grew up in without access to a good public education, are not arriving at the starting line with the kind of personal resources to go get a good job. In my mind, creating a sort of bridging strategy that isn't just sending people checks, but is getting them jobs and training and upskilling them, is the way you navigate that dilemma. So getting people into workers' co-ops where they are earning a living seems better than the other options.
Do you feel like those co-ops, though, should be tax supported, or are there pros and cons to having them supported by privately run nonprofits and organizations?
Well, so the Anchor Institution model, I suppose, lumps together private organizations as well as public ones, right? You can imagine a private university as well as a public university mm-hmm. supporting that strategy. I think it's a reasonable strategy for both the private ones and the public ones if it's lifting up the community and it's consistent with their missions.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. Tom is on the line in Hearst. Hi, Tom.
Hi. My question was on that Cleveland model you talked about. And my specific question is, the couple that owned the laundry that lost the business that still has all a loan for all the equipment they bought to take care of the business, how do they pay off their loan?
Is there a couple that lost a business?
Well, no, but somebody's losing the business and had borrowed money to buy the equipment.
I don't think anybody lost a business. I mean, there may be a level of detail I don't know about, but I think they started a new business and bought new equipment.
So you say, going back to your car sharing venture, according to your own criteria and that of your colleagues, it was only partially successful. Talk first about what worked, and then maybe we'll talk about what didn't and what you would do differently today.
Yeah, great question. I mean, we had some big ambitions. We wanted to create an open source sharing software platform that anybody in the world could use, to share vehicles, possibly to share other things. This was before the sharing economy was a term and before there was for-profit versions of that. We also wanted a network of car sharing organizations to be confederating together, rather like the public radio stations that enable me to be sitting in San Francisco doing this interview in Texas, and the kind of network of public radio stations which together can make a lot of shared investments in things like national and international news. We had that same idea that a network of nonprofit car sharing organizations could save money buying insurance and buying vehicles and paying for technology. And so we devoted a lot of energy to helping other car sharing organizations get started in other cities. But in the long run, most of them didn't make it, and that dream did not materialize.
So that makes it harder if you have devoted even just the resource of like time and energy. That's time and energy that was taken away from your venture.
Yeah, it's true. Mm-hmm. It's true.
So talk about, obviously you learned a lot, and your candor in the book is really impressive. Talk about the ways that the venture evolved from the start into what it ultimately became and why you decided to leave it behind.
I guess we had a real belief that two of my best friends and I started this together, and we had a belief from the very start that if it was going to work, it needed to not just be our baby, but we had to get it started. We had to recruit a new generation of leaders, and then we had to get out of the way. And so so we did. We didn't want to do it forever. We all had other jobs. We were definitely not looking to spend our lives running this. And so we handed it off to the next generation. And I guess I would say they were much better managers. They knew how to make it efficient and sustainable. And so absolutely that was the right thing. I would say it lost some of its kind of activist, idealistic zeal and got to be a little more nuts and bolts about the business. And so that's okay. That's the maybe the natural evolution of things.
In what consumer space do you see the sharing economy having the most potential in the foreseeable future?
Well, if you think about kind of the big capital investments, you know, there's buildings and there's vehicles. And I think today we see a very well-developed sharing economy business model for both of those. So that's, you know, there are now dozens of for-profit car sharing companies, something we never imagined was possible. And there are now these, you know, what sometimes get called dynamic ride sharing companies like Uber and Lyft. And then on the building side, there's Airbnb and VRBO and a bunch of companies like that. So I think the insights that began with environmental activists have been picked up by the broader business community, which I actually think is a good thing. I call that success. And what that means for activists is that it's time to move on to the next project.
So it's not a disappointment that things like Uber and VRBO are for profit, as long as they're doing the kind of thing that you know, people with maybe higher motives had in the first place?
Well, it means that if we have a better idea of how to do things like that, we should try to start organizations that will do it better. I think it is a tried and true story in American life that activists start something that ends up getting taken up and becoming mainstream. I mean, I think that the credit union movement was so radical in its early days, you know, providing banking to the working class, and then it became a normal mainstream thing.
Gabriel Metcalf's new book is called Democratic by Design: How Car Sharing, Co-ops, and Community Land Trusts Are Reinventing America. Gabriel, it's been a great hour. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great Thanksgiving.